There have been some great advances so far in the history of medicine, but for the first time, technology is enabling us to move from just hospital-based illness care to more ongoing patient-based prevention, and that is a really exciting change for all of us. Hello and welcome to everyone. This is Don Dingy. I am part of the editorial staff with Open Systems Media and editor of Embedded Computing Design magazine. I'll be your moderator for this program on Enabling Telehealth Devices with Embedded Computing, sponsored by Gramatech and Microchip Technology. We'll introduce our four expert guests shortly, but first we will do a quick tour of your viewing experience. I'll have a couple of thoughts. We will then hear from our experts, and we'll take your questions in a Q&A session. If you've been with us before, you know how this all works. Bear with me a minute. If it's your first time, thanks for joining. And here's some viewing tips for the session. You are seeing slides on the right half of your screen, and if you'd like, you can go to a larger view just by clicking that Enlarge Slides button. You can also download these slides in a PDF format. The slides we're using today, if you click download, you'll get those directly. You can also invite a friend who should be watching this. And then finally, the audience participation part on the lower left-hand side of the screen, the Ask a Question box. I'll be selecting questions from your submissions for our Q&A session right after the presentation. Stay tuned. Just type your question in that box and hit Submit Question. Really easy, and we do have super experts, but I wanted to take a second and set the tone for this event. Telehealth is a rapidly growing market. There's some market estimates that show that there are $8 billion in the connected healthcare device market in 2012. Funding notwithstanding, there's some government issues going on that you might have heard about, but certainly it is a growing market. And as I mentioned, it's more than just care. It's moving to prevention. It's moving into both clinical and home use environments and broader use by less experienced users. And we'll talk about some of those issues. But a couple of the devices on the left are particularly interesting. In the upper left-hand corner is a device from Sanofi Aventis. It's the IBG Star. It is a blood glucose monitor. You simply plug it into your iPhone, and the little device shown on the right there plugs into the iPhone port, and small app on the iPhone allows transmission of your readings to a healthcare provider so that you can cooperate with your healthcare provider in monitoring your own blood glucose levels. That's a super idea. On the bottom is the Bosch HealthBuddy device, again, a home-based device made for people to communicate with their healthcare providers. So we're seeing phones, smartphone types of things. We're seeing purpose-built embedded devices, and then we're seeing more traditional devices in clinical settings. And we wanted to discuss all of the above of those in our first part of the presentation, the current state of telehealth. And I want to go ahead and introduce our first speaker today with that idea in mind. Ron Riesenbach's broad career has focused on the management and application of information technology to improve economic prosperity and quality of life. His career includes titles like research scientist, technology manager, academic program director, high-tech entrepreneur, and he's currently VP of emerging business for the Ontario Telemedicine Network. He holds an MSc in electrical engineering and an MBA, and in his spare time, he is pursuing a bachelor's in biology and chemistry. Ron, I think I could have just read Renaissance Man and said just as much, but we are ready for your presentation, Ron.
Thank you very much, Don, for the great introduction. For those that aren't that familiar with the Canadian scene, Ontario is a large province which accounts for something like a third of the population. It's a very large place. In fact, if you took California, Texas, and through in Maryland, you'd approach the size in square miles of our province. We have about 13 million people in the province, and about a quarter of them live in rural and remote areas. These are places that are difficult to get to, weather is an issue, and even telecommunications can be challenging in those areas. And it was from this base that our organization, the Ontario Telemedicine Network, was born. We are a not-for-profit organization that uses provincial government money to fund and support a province-wide telemedicine network. We are an organization of about $23 million in size, just approximately, give or take, every year. And we are, to the best of our knowledge, the world's largest integrated telemedicine network. Just for some more stats to give you some idea of our size, we have about 190 people. Last year, we did 102,000 clinical consults, and these are encounters between patients and their healthcare providers, docs and nurses and other allied health professionals. And we did it largely through two-way video conferencing. I would say 90% of our activity is two-way video conferencing on a kind of a clinical telemedicine delivery basis. This is from small referring sites like a community health center, referring into a large academic health science center. Using appliance-based video conferencing gear, we have reached out and have involved more than 3,000 healthcare providers in hundreds of different healthcare specialties. We're not a pediatrics network nor a psychiatry network. We're all of them. We do a lot of different kinds of healthcare. We use the same gear, the same equipment that's used to deliver healthcare to patients is also used for CME, continuing medical education. So the healthcare providers talk to one another over the video conferencing gear to the tune of some 20,000 events per year. The video conferencing equipment we use isn't the PC-based systems that your daughter uses, like Skype, MSN, and others. We are using what we call clinical-grade video conferencing systems. They're more expensive, they're appliance-based, but they do provide us with quality of service, controllability, and other features that are critical in a healthcare environment. Here's a snapshot of a typical telemedicine cart you might find inside a clinical environment. These systems are built to order for us, although they're sold by our vendors to any buyer, and they have like big fat wheels on them to enable them to get over elevator thresholds. They have folding monitors to enable them to run down a hallway without decapitating somebody. They have electrical isolation and lockable drawers to keep theft away. So they're ergonomically designed and equipped in order to be able to deliver a patient to a remote physician. Here's a snapshot. It'll refresh on your screen in a moment. Here's a snapshot of what one of these systems look like in a small clinic. It's not an antiseptic made-to-use room. It's a general-purpose examination room, and these systems have to be able to be rolled into a corner and turned off when not used, and then rolled out and quickly brought to life and be in a fully managed mode when they're turned on. So you can see the nurse on the right-hand side with the white coat is presenting the patient to the clinician at the far side. The nurse is always present to present the patient. One more slide that'll update on your screens in a moment is that we have these systems produced in the hundreds for us and are deployed across the province. We have over 2,000 video conferencing endpoints, not all mobile carts as you're looking at right now. Some of them wall mount, a few desktop appliances, and a few of the higher end systems that we use in operating theaters. Our volumes have been growing exponentially year by year. This is a very well-received service with a great deal of provider and patient satisfaction, and our numbers are escalating. This year, I think we'll be doing at least 30% more volume than we did the previous year. So with these opening remarks, I think I'll pause here and pass it back to Don.
Thank you, Ron. We will have Ron back for some thoughts on the future and our Q&A session. If you have any questions on what Ron's doing, feel free to put those into your tool. We're going to go ahead and introduce our second expert. Steve Canelli leads the Medical Products Group at Microchip Technology, addressing the specific needs of the medical device industry. His career includes more than 25 years of experience in program management, marketing, sales, and application engineering at places like Motorola, ON Semiconductor, Microchip Technology, GoMode alumni. He holds a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Arizona State University. Steve, we are ready for you.
Thanks very much, Don. Appreciate it. So let's start by looking at some of the topics that I plan to cover today. To begin with, the rise in popularity in wireless medical devices will consider the advantages that wireless capability can bring to these devices. And then we'll look at some of the challenges that are faced by designers when they decide to make a device wireless. Then we'll look at what the industry is doing to overcome those challenges in order to make wireless work. And finally, I'll have some comments about where we see the future direction of wireless technology in medical devices. So we all use all kinds of wireless things every day, and the addition of wireless technology can bring lots of benefits to medical devices also. Depending on the type of device, designers have different reasons for considering wireless communication. In some cases, a wireless link is used to replace a traditional wire. This is often done in things like sensors, where a wire might work, but wireless is more convenient. While we also see this kind of motivation in many consumer devices, in a medical device, convenience can increase a patient's willingness to use a device, or also a hospital's ability to integrate that device into a nurse's workflow, and that can actually impact patient outcomes. Another category to consider is that of medical devices that just couldn't work or would be impractical without wireless communication. The obvious example here is anything that's designed to be used inside the body of a person while they go about their normal life. This includes not only surgically implanting devices, but also devices that are swallowed for monitoring, drug delivery, internal imaging, lots of other purposes. Another rising trend in medical devices is what we were just hearing about, and that is the advent of devices remotely, possibly even in patients' homes, that gather data and either store it or relay it on for subsequent analysis. And as we'll see a little bit later, this medical data sharing creates lots of opportunities for wireless communication. One attribute of this last category, which is also shared to some degree by the others, is that these devices are intended to be used by people with little or no special training. And for this reason, these devices also benefit from small, fast, low-power microcontrollers that enable the designers to make the devices smart enough to work without direct human supervision. Something like a continuous glucose monitor, for example, not only lets the user lead a better life, but it also gives the user's doctor much better data on how their condition is being managed, leading directly to improved outcomes. So with all the goodness that comes from adding wireless communication to medical devices, you may well ask why everything isn't wireless. And like most things, there's a number of reasons. Adding any capability to an electronic device requires a rebalancing of equations relating factors like cost, size, and power consumption, and this is certainly the case for adding wireless as well. Not only do the transceivers, antennas, and other components required directly affect these factors, but the additional complexity in the system may also require more performance from the microcontrollers and other components in the device. Of course, this situation is familiar to anyone who's worked in any electronic device development. It's certainly not specific to wireless. But in addition to these typical hurdles, there are other challenges that are unique to wireless devices. The Smith chart that's on this slide represents the specialized nature of RF design engineering, which is truly its own world. Quite apart from the challenges of the design work, most countries regulate the use of the electromagnetic spectrum and require certification of any device transmitting in certain frequency bands. Now, medical device manufacturers are certainly accustomed to working in a regulated environment, but this certification process adds another government agency to the product development process. Finally, if a company's wireless device is going to be able to communicate with devices from other manufacturers, then they will all have to agree with everybody else on transmission frequency, data rates and formats, and a lot of other parameters in order to ensure operability. And it's this last challenge that has been the motivation behind the development of a number of standards in wireless communication. In the beginning, all wireless systems were proprietary links. Companies basically defined their own protocols for each device or each application, and they retained complete control over all the specifications. This approach is still used today in cases where interoperability is not important, or maybe where it's actually not even desired. The other protocols that are shown on this chart were developed specifically to allow equipment from various manufacturers to interact. And in each case, one of the goals is to enable cross-device communication with a minimum of effort by the user. Each of these approaches has its own set of advantages and disadvantages, and it's not really possible in this forum to dive too deeply into those, but it is worth mentioning some differences and similarities. Proprietary links are usually employed in systems with fairly modest range and bandwidth requirements. Since every device is communicating with another device from the same maker its design doesn't have to anticipate a large number of use cases. For these and a few other reasons, proprietary links can present a relatively modest burden on an MCU in a system and make for pretty cost-effective systems overall. The other standardization options for communication up to several hundred meters that are shown on this slide are probably better known, including Zigbee, Bluetooth, and Wi-Fi. Besides the differences in data rates that are shown along the bottom of the picture, each of these protocols offers different capabilities for various network topologies, for power conservation strategies, for security, and usability with other existing devices. It's also worth mentioning that each of these protocols achieves its goal of interoperability by using an embedded microcontroller to handle the negotiation between units and to control the radios. This control is managed by software that's specific to each protocol. In the case of simple devices like a glucometer, weight scale, and things like that, the communication stack may actually be considerably larger than the code that makes the device perform its primary function. Microchip solutions for these protocols are designed to complement the technical strengths of each of them. For example, Zigbee targets low power and fairly low data rate devices. These devices can operate in mesh networks in a broad range of sizes. Mesh networks allow many different devices to communicate with each other and also with hub-like controllers. Embedded Wi-Fi, compatible with the Wi-Fi found in familiar things like laptops and wireless routers that's already in everybody's house, is intended for devices that don't need to be constantly connected to a network. The stack in embedded Wi-Fi is optimized for size to leave as much memory as possible available to the primary application. It can also be integrated into systems that don't have operating systems to further reduce the demand for simple devices. As I mentioned before, proprietary ISM band systems are not necessarily designed for interoperability across equipment manufacturers. Components for proprietary links are designed for maximum flexibility to allow system designers as much freedom as possible to work around the other constraints in their systems. And for each of these protocols, Microchip has a variety of solutions to help designers. For the most flexibility, there are transceiver chips for each protocol. These ISM Wi-Fi and Zigbee transceivers are all designed for low power consumption. And when combined with a low power MCU, these components enable maximum battery life in a handheld portable kind of application. For designs that need to be minimize risk or design time, there are transceiver modules that connect to a microcontroller via a simple serial interface. These modules are complete radios, including integrated PCB antennas, and a key advantage of using this option is that all the RF engineering is already done, including the certification of these modules by the various regulatory agencies in U.S., Canada, and Europe. Since the radio modules are pre-certified, that hurdle is removed from the development of the end device. And finally, no matter what radio technology or circuit topology is selected, Microchip has hardware and software tools for the development of wireless devices along with every other kind of microcontroller application. The available support includes software stacks and example codes for lots of common use cases. So if we now consider a typical real-life example of how wireless technology is used in medical devices, one natural observation is that even in a single system, there may be a need for multiple wireless technologies. In this example, you can consider a portable medical device, and a typical household might have half a dozen or so of these devices that are used by various family members on a regular basis. The objective here is to transfer data from the portable device to some server that can be accessed by the patient's healthcare provider or a responsible family member or somebody else involved in the patient's care. Like always, there's lots of ways to do this, including maybe putting a cellular modem into the portable device, allowing it to communicate directly with the remote server. While this is the most direct kind of link, in many cases it may not be the most feasible. Something like a thermometer or a blood pressure cuff is a good example of a kind of device that would benefit from the low cost and low power that comes from using a Zigbee radio. As we saw before, this technology has a usable range of maybe a couple hundred meters, which means the data will need to be handed off to another device. And in this example, we're using a home medical appliance like the Bosch Health Buddy that Don mentioned before, to collect the data from all the devices in the home and then use the household Wi-Fi network to access the internet and from there to get to the secure server. Another observation that you make when you look at this is that you've got one server serving many households and each household having potentially many devices. And like typical consumer products, the higher number of devices getting closer to the end user introduces a cost sensitivity into the adoption rate, which is another argument for very low-cost devices with the data taking several steps to get to its final destination. And finally, while it's not explicitly shown here, the entire communication chain can also be two-way, allowing a physician to not only monitor but also modify parts of a patient's care. Don, back to you.
Thanks, Steve, very much. We're going to bring on our third expert guest for a slightly different perspective. We will have Steve back later. Please submit your questions for him. Dr. Jean-Pierre Offret is co-founder and director of the Center for Advanced Technology Strategy, and he's also vice chairman of the board of the Northern Virginia Regional Health Information Organization, NovaRIO. He has 25 years of technology industry and academic experience, including time as an executive at MCI and recent director of the Masters in Technology Management program at George Mason University, where he instructs. JP earned a BS degree from Duke University, an MBA from the University of Virginia, and a PhD in physics from American University. JP, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Don. Wanted to try to do a couple of things today. One is to give some perspective on the healthcare environment and the mHealth and the telehealth environment in regard to developing applications and starting applications, and also the regulatory environment. First, I wanted to show a couple of examples with the idea of trying to illustrate how telehealth or mHealth is really appropriate at whatever stage a country or a region is at from an ICT's perspective, and also how there's quite a range of business models which are impacted by how rapidly the technology is changing. The first one on the left is a relatively new business in India. It's an interactive voice response business, but one of the main things it's doing is providing healthcare information to citizens and residents of rural India. Second example, Nokia Life is doing something different. They have a big initiative in Indonesia. They're too providing health information to residents. The next two are a little bit different. Ushahidi is an initiative that was started in Africa, but now has had a lot of impact around the world, including the flooding in Bangladesh and earthquake aftermath in Haiti. And it's a mashup, essentially, combining GIS information with SMS to be able to show regions of need. And then lastly, the iPad. Here is something from UC Irvine, where every new student, medical school student, is being given an iPad, but also being used more and more in the clinical settings for the convenience and the capability of the device. As an overview then, so that these types of initiatives are possible worldwide in different stages. They have different business models, the Baitar Zinghaghi and advertising business model, and then also different types of phone capability. So several of these are SMS-based, one is a smartphone-based, but these types of devices are really coalescing as Qualcomm with its Blue platform is moving up market towards the smartphone, and Google Android is actually trying to move down market to attract more and more regular cell phone users. So I think in the next couple of years, there are going to be really low-priced smartphones that really available to much larger percentage of the cell phone market, mobile available smartphones. This third slide shows some of the environmental changes that are ongoing today, environmental background, and for the potential of mHealth and telehealth. One of the main ones is that there's electronic health record incentive programs with a goal of 2014, ultimately, for the adoption for everyone in the country to have an electronic health record. Initially, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services is providing incentives for use by physicians, but ultimately it's going to be a reimbursement penalty. So these EHR incentive programs and the criteria for the reimbursement is called meaningful use, that there's a number of guidelines, is really pushing providers towards IT and ultimately towards telehealth and mHealth. Second major development is HIEs and RIOs. nationwide and most states, fledgling health information exchanges, and some much more advanced. The new Health Care Act is really driving reimbursements. And one of the main areas that's driving reimbursements is for readmissions. So within 30 days of someone's readmitted to a hospital for a similar illness, there's going to be less or, in fact, in many cases, no reimbursement to the hospital. And this is a motivation and incentives for hospitals to get more and more into home health, to interact with the patient more after they're discharged from the hospital, and to connect with them in their home, thereby driving adoption of some telehealth and telemedicine and mHealth technologies. Then lastly, telehealth and telemedicine reimbursements. The main driver of this nationwide is through Medicare, through something called health professional shortage areas, where there are Medicare reimbursements for telehealth. But states, on a case-by-case basis, are also pushing for reimbursements. And this last year in Virginia, the Virginia legislature made a distinction and was quite positive for reimbursements in the telemedicine area, but they wanted to bound it, and so defined it as telemedicine and not telehealth. On the opportunity side, a lot of the discussions are on clinical opportunities, but really quite a bit of them are administrative and back office and physician practice in hospitals. And then in public health surveillance and monitoring, all the states have a list of illnesses and diseases that need to be reported from clinics into the state. In a lot of cases, those aren't automated. The potential to connect disparate elements of the healthcare value chain, for instance, in stroke care, where it's quite disaggregated, enhancing the continuity of care, facilitating care transitions. This is the area where most medical errors are made when a person goes from one healthcare provider to another, or even within a hospital during a nursing shift transition. And obviously, a lot of potential for health information, and then in the global health area. I'll just go through this last one or two real quickly and turn it back over to Don. Some of the big trends is networks and phones being advances are incredible. The mobile ecosystems are quite stronger now than a couple of years ago, and in the MTAM area, and in fact in the applications area, are our major telephone providers, making it much easier for onboarding. And then these mobile app stores, many of the largest countries, even developing countries in the world, the major telecom providers and some independent providers now have app stores, which are enabling some of the mHealth applications. And then some of the mHealth larger trends, the new devices. I think machine-to-machine is going to have a very large impact and really open up the marketplace, melding them with location-based services, the potential of 4G, then integrating sensors and cameras. There's many, many new innovations which are enabling healthcare through having cameras and sensors, for example, in the area of dermatology. And then also the BSS to OSS capability is really keeping pace and I think has the potential to provide have a leadership role in mHealth and telehealth. So with that, Don, I'd like to turn it back to you.
Thanks, JP. We are going to have JP back for a look at the futures real quickly after our fourth perspective on medical device software quality, a little different than what we've heard so far. Dr. Paul Anderson is VP of Engineering at Gramatech, where he manages the engineering team and is the architect of the company's static analysis tools. Paul has worked in the software industry for 18 years, most of his experience focused on developing static analysis, automated testing, and program transformation tools. He received a BSc from King's College, University of London, and his PhD in computer science from the City University of London. Paul, we are ready for you.
Well, thank you, Don, for that introduction. So all this telehealth advances, all these improvements are very promising, but the success of whether they're going to be useful or not is going to hinge very strongly on the quality of the software that's driving all these devices. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So many of you may be familiar with the risk that software brings to all sorts of embedded processor development. Software has always contained risks. Some of you may know of the Therac 25 failures from a couple of decades ago. So these are the well-known as the archetypal examples of software failures in devices that caused deaths. In this case, the Therac 25 was a radiation therapy machine. It ended up killing several people, and the problem was eventually traced back to errors in the software itself. Now, that was several decades ago, and since then, of course, the use of software has increased enormously. And more recently, it's becoming almost like an epidemic of software failures that have caused recalls. So between 1999 and 2005, out of devices that involved software, one in three recalls of those devices were due to errors in the software itself. And of course, as the use of software in medical devices continues to grow, you're just going to see more and more of these kinds of things happening. And of course, as we're involving new technologies in medical health, new risks are emerging. So that's the next slide. So this is, of course, about telehealth. That means you have to have some kind of connectivity, but every time you connect a device to a network, you're increasing its vulnerability to all sorts of nasty things. So there are security vulnerabilities in network devices that people, unscrupulous people, will take advantage of. In particular, in 2008, with a wireless device, some researchers demonstrated an attack on an implantable defibrillator, where they were able to take control of the device and put it into a test mode, which caused it to deplete the battery and put the life of the patient at risk. So these are definitely serious risks. And then there's multi-core devices. So this is another new technology. Multi-core devices, in order to take advantage of their power, you have to use concurrent programming techniques. These are notoriously difficult to get right. You have things like race conditions and deadlock and so on, and these cause severe problems in the devices. So the FDA is well aware of these problems, so I have a slide here on what they're planning to do about it. So first of all, they make no bones about the fact that they do consider software itself to be a medical device. Now, the long-term approach is to introduce new regulations to control the use of software in medical devices much more tightly. But they realize that in the long term, between now and then, there may be lots of additional failures. So what they're trying to do in the interim is to increase awareness of best practices of software development in the industry and reaching out to manufacturers and trying to get manufacturers to improve the software quality themselves. As part of this, one of the things they've done recently is to offer pre-market services for certain kinds of devices, specifically infusion pumps. I'll say more about that in a little bit, to help manufacturers improve the quality of the software in those devices. So they've adopted IEC 62304 as one of the best practices, but another set of things that they're doing are trying to improve coding standards and to foster the use of static analysis when they're doing investigations. So, and I have a case study of this in a little bit, but what they're doing in this case is they have adopted a policy where if there is an investigation into a device and that device contains software, they will use static analysis tools on that source code and then require the manufacturers to explain any abnormal findings. So in particular, in this pre-market review of infusion pumps, they've established this pilot program where they will actually do that on the software in advance of it getting to the market. And they intend to extend this to other devices in the future. So here's a case study of the kind of thing that the FDA are doing. So and at the FDA, they have the software forensics lab. Anytime there's a failure in a software device, in a medical device that uses software, they have the responsibility of looking at that in detail and figuring out what went wrong, trying to find out what the root cause is. In this case, and I think this might have been an infusion pump, I'm not entirely sure. In this case, the device had failed in the field, and it caused several recalls. So they took a static analysis tool, and this was our static analysis tool, and they ran it on that code, and they found that there were 127 serious problems in that code, of which the manufacturer was aware of only 82 of them. So for those 45 that had not been previously known, the manufacturer was required to explain away those defects and to conduct a further investigation to see if that was in fact the root cause of the problem. So I have some links here which you can look at later when you download the presentations that explain the FDA's approach to software validation. And that middle link there, the FDA letter to infusion pump manufacturers, is pretty is one of the most interesting things they've come out with recently. So this is very clear about the risk of software in medical devices. They I have that letter in front of me. I'll just quote from a couple of things. So between January the 1st, 2005 and December 31st, 2009, the FDA received 56,000 recalls associated with the use of infusion pumps. So these were 56,000 incidents. Of those, approximately 1% were reported as deaths and 34% were reported as serious injuries. And the most frequently reported problem in those infusion pumps happened to be software errors. So this indicates that they're extremely concerned about the software rate in medical devices and are encouraging manufacturers to use best practices, among which is the use of static analysis tools and the adoption of software development principles. And back to you, Don.
Paul, thanks. The one outtake of that for everybody should be, you know, microcontrollers, software. There is more intelligent content coming in these telehealth devices. And we asked our panelists to break the presentation into a couple pieces so we could discuss where they see all this going in the future of telehealth. And I want to invite JP back online right now to discuss what he is seeing. JP?
Thank you, Don. Just a couple of points, and I'll turn it back to Don and to our other panelists. I think one of the major things is with the opportunity that's present today, there's many new entrants into the telehealth field. So some from traditional telecom. So, for example, Verizon has a new health information exchange offering that they're doing. Intel has been directly into home health for a number of years, but they and General Electric have started a new joint venture together just within the last couple of months. So these new entrants, I think, are going to shape to some degree the evolution of telehealth. And I think, too, with the complexity of the value chain and the ecosystems for telehealth and for mobile apps, I think it places a premium on partnering, because there's very few companies that have the expertise all the way across the wireless as well as the health area. And so the partnering will give them access to technology, distribution, healthcare providers, and the like. Second area, I think, which is somewhat of a challenge, all the hospitals and physicians have healthcare workflows or workflows for their practices. One of the challenges is integrating mHealth and telehealth into those workflows. So that's certainly a benefit to the patients, but also is helpful or beneficial or consistent with the practices of the hospital or the physicians. So that's a benefit and not a hindrance. I think in the third point in the U.S., but also overseas, maybe even more especially in developing countries, A lot of great pilot projects, telehealth and mobile health pilot projects, a lot of really good applications, but a big challenge in building ones that are scalable, sustainable, have good business models, and are viable. A fourth challenge is, with all the applications, there's a real need for rigorous measurement and validation of the benefits, both for the developers, certainly for the patients, but also for reimbursement purposes, that the better the validation and the measurement is, the more straightforward to persuade insurers and CMS and legislators too are involved in reimbursement to approve reimbursements. Thank you, Don. Those are the four points I'd like to make.
AP, thanks. Let's try Steve with what he sees for wireless in our future. Steve?
All right, thanks very much. We're engaged with something around 500 clients who are developing and manufacturing medical devices. And what I want to talk about is a few of the things that we see in talking with them about where the future is going. One of the trends that we expect to be influential is rising user expectations. As more consumer devices take advantage of modern user interfaces and wireless technology to enhance the user's experience, those users will probably start looking for that same kind of experience in other types of devices, including anything used for telehealth or that they've got at home for healthcare. At the same time, more capable microcontrollers are enabling the creation of even more new medical devices. These devices will bring closer to reality the vision of distributed healthcare, telehealth, and people really being able to better choose the amount of control that they want to have over their healthcare. In order for this future of home healthcare to be realized, we think more standards are going to need to be developed and adopted by the makers of medical devices intended for home use. Even as that standardization increases, the devices will be made smarter, allowing them to be usable by more people and hence additional flexibility in the market. The result of all of this is going to be more wireless medical devices being invented and used at home and elsewhere, leading to lower cost, more effective health care for more people. Thanks, Don.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Paul, let's try your take on where the future goes.
Okay, so we are a tool company. We sell tools, and we conduct research into tools that will help people improve the quality of their code. So what we see coming up is a lot of focus is going to be on the security of the software that's running these devices. So what we are coming up with is new static analysis approaches that will help people find security vulnerabilities in their source code. We also see an increasing use of concurrency in code, especially with the adoption of multi-core processors, as I mentioned earlier. And so you will see additional tools coming out that will help you find errors in such as race conditions and deadlocks and so on in those. And finally, because the use of software is growing enormously, simply the quantity of software is getting much more difficult for people to manage. So what you will see coming up is source code visualization tools, simply to help programmers and engineers look at the code and understand how it all fits together and to help them understand the risks of it. And that's all. Thank you, Don.
Paul, Ron, you had an interesting take with a couple of slides here on what's happening in the home and where your network's headed. Let's hear what you've got.
Right. So we are a telemedicine service provider. We're an operator of telemedicine services up here in Canada. So we're where the coal face is. We're taking these systems that are developed, taking the biotelemetry devices, be they wired or wireless, and actually bringing them to the marketplace. We conducted in 2009. We conducted a trial up here of 813 patients, which were equipped with home biotelemetry devices to monitor CHF, chronic heart failure, CPOD, chronic pulmonary obstructive disorder, and diabetes. And we used a very primitive technology. I'm just going to try and go to the previous slide here because I think we got... There we go. We use a technology that's 10 years old by a company called VitalNet in the East Coast of the States, which was recently bought by Bosch. And because it was old, it was low tech, and most things were wired, and it had a device aggregator that was connected to a telephone line. So there's no internet involved, very little wireless. The key message here was that even with such simple devices and technologies, the results were amazing. So I've got good news and bad news for all you manufacturers out there, is that the good news is that even simple biotelemetry devices have significant positive health outcomes. So here's the positive health outcomes. With this 813-person trial, and this is independently validated numbers by PricewaterhouseCoopers, we had a 65% decrease in hospitalization admissions, 70% reduction in emergency hospital visits, something like a 25 to 30% decrease in the number of primary care physician visits, a huge reduction in walk-in clinician visits with very high satisfaction levels. Very high. So even using plain old telephone line with wired devices, gathering this biotelemetry devices, we had great healthcare outcomes. So what's the bad news? The bad news is that simple biotelemetry devices have huge impact on health outcomes. So the need for complex, risky devices is going to be a hard case to press when simple devices will do such a great job at making a difference. And the key difference in our trial, the key difference was health coaching, nothing to do with technology, having to do with sociology. We had nurses that were helping these patients monitor their biotelemetry readings every day, look at them on a screen, and when they would go out of bounds, the nurse would call the patients and educate them and explain to them why having that salty meal the night before threw your readings into a tizzy. And like they say, if you teach a man to fish, he will be able to feed himself for a long time. We taught the patients to self-manage their ailment using simple devices to monitor their health outcomes. So this is a key thing about our next trial that we're currently planning. We're planning a very large province-wide telehome care rollout that will involve multiple nurses with each monitoring between 50 and 100 patients, and it'll be centrally managed by our team here at OTN. We've designed an architecture for it. In fact, there's an RFP out on the street on this right now. But the most complex part of things is not to the right hand of that black line, the patient side with all the biotelemetry devices, et cetera. The most complex part for us is the information aggregation, control, dissemination, decision support systems, and their interface back into the further systems upstream. That's the part where we anticipate we're going to have the most challenge in our upcoming trial. And by the way, this trial will involve up to 40,000 patients over a 3 or 4 year period. So the key message over here is that keep doing this fantastic work, but take into consideration that even simple devices can have a huge impact on health outcomes. Back to you, Don.
Ron, thank you very much. A reminder, our guests today, which we're about to enter our Q&A session, are Ron Riesenbach of the Ontario Telemedicine Network, Steve Canelli of Microchip Technology, J.P. Offret of the Center for Advanced Technology Strategy in Nova Rio, and Paul Anderson of Gramatech. I want to take one of the easiest questions first. It might not be terribly obvious, but does the FDA require medical manufacturers to follow the 510K process? 510K is pre-market notification, and yeah, actually the devices I showed on my slide in the beginning, the Sanofi Aventis device, the IBG Star, is not available in the U.S. right now. If you go hit that website, it says not intended for United States residents. The device is selling in Europe, and it's not selling in the U.S. because the FDA has not approved it. The rules haven't changed for the FDA. Devices do need to be certified, brought through the process. This has two effects. One, it provides the manufacturer's legal liability protection, and two, it makes sure that devices do what they are advertised to do, so there's protection for both the manufacturer and the users in here. But the rules aren't changing, and that's something we're going to explore here in a little bit. I want to start with Dr. Anderson and see what he thinks. So there's a couple of issues related to the infusion pump letter itself. Software errors are the number one problem in over 56,000 reports over a five-year period. As we see more and more devices, what's going to happen with the number of reports if people don't do something? How should designers change their process? Is static code analysis the only answer or part of the answer? Paul, what do you think?
Well, you're certainly going to see many more software errors, and I think one of the most worrying things is you're going to see a lot more security errors showing up as well. You know, with that many devices running on such an interconnected network, it seems to be inevitable that that security is going to be a huge, huge issue. Certainly, static code analysis is not by any means the only answer to this kind of thing. Developers have to adopt rigorous software development standards. They may have to try to model their software development practices after what's done in the aerospace industry, where they have extremely good coverage testing of their code and things like that, and where they separate the software into different components, where each component has a different risk, and where they use very high quality testing methodologies. I hope that helps.
You mentioned failure mode effects analysis. I think at least you alluded to it. Is that part of the equation right now, and are you able to incorporate that methodology?
Well, certainly manufacturers do use some forms of failure mode effects analysis. One of the issues that the FDA has mentioned to us is that there's a huge variety of different software development and testing methodologies in use across all the different manufacturers, and as a consequence, you get manufacturers where their development is very good, and you get manufacturers where the software development is treated as a kind of an afterthought, where they don't really pay as much attention to the software as they do to the hardware, and they see that that's a problem. And they see that leveling the quality of software development and raising it at all across the board, across all the different kinds of manufacturers, is something that they want to do.
So, JP, hinging into both of those questions, we've got these mHealth users, and they're fairly technology savvy. They drive smartphones. How do they have confidence in the apps that are out there? Are these apps undergoing certification like a device would for accuracy, security, those kinds of issues? What's going on in that area?
Well, I think one of the main initiatives was from the summer the FDA and the FCC started to work together on these types of devices in areas where they have joint overlapping jurisdiction. And the thought was to develop approaches similar to what the FDA does now to try to balance the interest in innovation and attracting investment with the need for safety. So I think over and what they did as part of the initiative, they put out a statement of guidelines of how they are looking to work together. And so I think over the coming months, we'll see more and more of results of those joint efforts.
So real quickly, what do you think is missing right now? Is it more applications, or is it integrating those mobile devices into the end-to-end communication solution?
Well, I think it's integrating the applications into the end-to-end communications, but also into the healthcare workflows. So there's adoption, but not just from the patient or the consumer. There's the adoption path for the physician, adoption for the hospitals, approval or insight from the regulatory authorities. So it's a bit of a long time frame, I think, for mobile apps to be adopted and be mainstream and have a significant impact in medicine compared to some of the other areas of mobile apps.
Interesting point is we're sending data in, somebody's got to be catching it on the other side. That's a really interesting point. It's going to change the workflow for not only the people but the healthcare providers as well.
Yeah.
Steve, a couple questions for you. You mentioned a wide range of wireless networking standards, and Wi-Fi has gotten very ubiquitous, as you mentioned. And some of the other networks like Zigbee and some of the other things you alluded to are not ubiquitous. Is Wi-Fi going to take over this space because it's everywhere, or are there going to be things emerging like combined Wi-Fi Zigbee gateways, and what are your views on that?
The gateway concept is an interesting one because I think that's probably where those home health appliances are going to go. I think they will either connect over Ethernet or via Wi-Fi into the home network, and then they will be able to communicate to the smaller devices via Zigbee, Bluetooth, maybe other protocols as well. So maybe that's a gateway. Maybe that's just something that knows how to talk to whatever you bring into your house.
And speaking of Wi-Fi, how are your devices rated as far as power? Are they short range? Are they extremely short range? Are you incorporating other features? Tell us about your Wi-Fi solution a little bit.
On power, there's probably a couple of different ways that you can answer that. I'll try to answer a couple of the short ways that I think you're looking for, and then. If anybody has other questions, they can email me to get some more information. But as far as transmit, we rate it at 10 dBm. That's plus 10 dBm, which is fairly typical for a netbook kind of transmit output. At that output rate, the system consumes about 154 milliamps. So if you're looking for the actual power consumption of the device, it's around there. And then that goes down to less than a microamp in the lowest power mode that is available on the device.
Ron, a couple questions here related. You covered one of the things, the psychographics of trying to move users, not only looking at what the device does itself, but being able to provide coaching. As we're getting multiple devices, you've got several questions here about, are you doing more PC-based stuff? Are you doing more mobile device stuff? Have you looked at PC-based as opposed to dedicated video conferencing tools? Maybe you could comment on the overall trends there and what you've tried and has worked and maybe hasn't worked.
Certainly. Just want to differentiate the two different environments. In the clinical environment, it's very much a B2B, business-to-business kind of transaction where healthcare providers connect with one another by video conference and other devices in order to present their patients to one another. In that particular environment, the key thing that we're trying to do are the pre-event scheduling. So a cardiologist isn't someone who is available ever. Their time has to be scheduled to the finest degree. In fact, what happens in the telemedicine environment is you sell thin slices of specialist time to referrers who are trying to refer their patients in. So in that business-to-business clinical environment, it's the pre-event coordination and workflow adaptation. It's the most important thing. The actual at-event time where you actually do a video conference connection with them can be in a static room, need not be mobile. The cardiologist knows where they have to be at the right time in order to have that encounter with the remote patient. Although we are indeed exploring PC-based and other handheld personal devices. We had an RFP out in the street that will be closing quite shortly to conclude that, and we'll have a PC-based solution too. On the patient side of things, we're dealing with the phenomenon here of an aging population. We have people that are in the chronically ill with multiple morbidities and multiple ailments that are typically elderly and are typically located in an environment where they have healthcare providers that are members of their family that are themselves suffering from various kinds of ailments. So in their particular environment, using PCs with keyboards and mice, et cetera, is not the first choice. We would prefer to use devices that are purpose-built, that have touch screens, that have ability for us to be able to communicate to them visually, orally, in multiple languages, and have the ability to be able to do things in a very simplistic way. So user interface design of these things is very important. So we're exploring all of these aspects of the ergonomics of the environment, both in the business-to-business as well as in the business-to-consumer health.
We could go on with this panel all afternoon, but I really appreciate the responses we've gotten. We do need to move to wrap this event up. If you're interested in these types of issues, and I think our panelists did a super job exploring telehealth, we are looking at an eHealth virtual conference, dedicating an entire day next March to 5 hours of programming on a wider agenda. We'll be looking at technology and issues touching on wireless and user interface, security, creative and innovative applications, and we'll have viewpoints and Q&A with more executives on these trends. Check back with us at the URL that's about to be on the screen for more details on that event as we get closer to that date. Today we've learned about enabling telehealth devices with embedded computing from our guests, Ron Riesenbach, Steve Kennelly, JP Offret, and Paul Anderson. Thanks to them for sharing their expertise and to Grammatech and Microchip Technology for their sponsorship. Besides registering for future events, this event and other eCasts are archived at the URL shown on the left. You can view these events at your convenience. Also on the left is the email address for a very hardworking woman whom I appreciate very, very much. That would be Christine Long. Thank you. If you enjoyed this program or have any comments about our eCasts, please share your thoughts with her, and thanks to all of you for being with us during this program. We hope you join us for future events. Be sure to visit embedded-computing.com for more information and ideas on telehealth and other topics in embedded design. On behalf of our guests and all of us here at Open Systems Media, this is Don Dingy saying find something good, build something better, and smile with someone today. See you soon.